Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
As the 2020 census confirms, Oregon has indeed become a state of immigrants, with foreign-born persons comprising nearly 10% of the state's total population. But in addition to numbers, immigrants and refugees live in communities dispersed throughout the state of Oregon and make vital contributions to our economic, social, civic, cultural, and political well-being.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's October 15, 2021 program. A State of Immigrants, a new look at the immigrant experience in Oregon. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the past City Club president. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. In today's program, we welcome our moderator, Bob Bussell, a tenured professor at the University of Oregon and director of the UO's Labor Education and Research Center, and speakers, Jose Melendez, a professor in the UO School of Planning, Public Policy, and Management, Dan Titchener, Knight Professor of Political Science at UO and director of the Wayne Morse Center's Program for Democratic Governance, and Lisha Shrestha, Executive Director of Division Midway Alliance, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to revitalizing the commercial district and improving community along Outer Division Street in East Portland. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. A State of Immigrants, a new look at the immigrant experience in Oregon. Since 1990, the population of foreign-born Oregon residents has grown 42% to a current level of almost 10%. Although we often call ourselves a nation of immigrants, our immigration policies seem to serve neither the established communities nor the newcomers very well. Federal efforts to adopt better policies have been derailed in recent years, leaving state governments and other institutions to work on this as a do-it-yourself project. Immigrants have a regenerative impact on the receiving community. They bring their talents, their energy, their perspectives, their culture, and their fresh appreciation for American values and resources. Although some start off in need of support, they quickly join the mainstream. Participation in the workforce for those 16 and older is about the same as other Americans, as is the number who remain in poverty. Offering them welcome and pathways for integrating into the social and economic life of their new hometowns ensures mutual benefits. In 2021, a team of researchers, sponsored by the UO Labor Education and Research Center, revisited their 2008 study to determine how much has changed for immigrants in Oregon since then. Their report examines public policies and community-level strategies aimed at helping immigrants and refugees in Oregon achieve social, civic, and economic integration in arenas such as education, health, employment, the arts, and political and civic participation. In this program, four authors of the 2021 report explain what they learned.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for this opportunity to appear before the Eugene City Club. My name is Bob Bussell. I'm the director of the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon, and I'm the editor of this new report titled A State of Immigrants, A New Look at the Immigrant Experience in Oregon, and I will be moderating today's discussion. I wanted to briefly provide a little bit of background on this report, its purpose and focus. And I also want to indicate that the report will soon be available, the full report, on the LERC website. That's LERC, L-E-R-C, at uoregon.edu. This report builds on previous research that we conducted titled Understanding the Immigrant Experience that first appeared in 2008. Much has changed since that 2008 report, both at the national and at the state and local level, and our contributors agreed that it was important and timely to try to make sense of these changes. As the 2020 census confirms, Oregon has indeed become a state of immigrants, with foreign-born persons comprising nearly 10% of the state's total population. But in addition to numbers, immigrants and refugees live in communities dispersed throughout the state of Oregon and make vital contributions to our economic, social, civic, cultural, and political well-being. These contributions have been underscored during the COVID-19 pandemic and growing public awareness of the essential work that immigrants perform, but we hasten to add that in addition to contributions in the workplace, immigrants make contributions in many other arenas that are the subject of this report. We've assembled a stellar team of publicly oriented scholars who have contributed to this report from the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, and this research has been supported by a grant from the Mellon Foundation's Just Futures Initiative. In the report, our contributors identify the challenges that immigrants and refugees face in adapting to their new environment and highlight efforts by immigrants and community-based institutions to help newcomers become acclimated and achieve a greater sense of acceptance and belonging. One of the key concepts underlying this research is immigrant integration, and I'm going to just steal a sliver of thunder from Leisha Shrestha, just a sliver, Leisha, in terms of how we define immigrant integration. And in Leisha's segment, she describes immigrant integration as, quote, a dynamic two-way process whereby immigrants and refugees develop a sense of belongingness that enables them to build relationships, craft identities, and explore new opportunities. The report covers critical arenas such as education and arts and culture. And before I reintroduce our contributors and turn this proceeding over to them, I wanted to add one final observation about the spirit of this report. It offers analysis of a state grappling with the legacy of its often exclusionary past toward immigrants and people of color, and it also looks at its attempts to embrace the possibilities of a more inclusionary future. And we sincerely hope that our research will support these possibilities. So let me now briefly reintroduce our panelists, and I will then kick things over to them. Leading off is Dan Tischner, a professor of political science and senior fellow at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. Dan will be speaking about the evolution of the politics of immigration in Oregon. Next up is Jose Melendez. Jose is an assistant professor in the UO School of Public Policy, Planning, and Management. He and his colleagues have studied civic engagement through service on decision-making. And finally, Leisha Shrestha is a doctoral candidate in the School of Social Work and Research at Portland State University and executive director of the Division Midway Alliance, a community organization that works closely with immigrants and refugees in Portland. And Leisha will be discussing a culturally specific approaches that engage and empower immigrants. So with that introduction, I am going to turn things over to Dan Tischner. Dan.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dan Tischner, and I'd like to start by thanking the City Club for hosting this panel discussion. And I'm especially grateful to Bob Bussell for his intellectual and organizational leadership that really was a driving force behind this publication. I have a few slides I'd like to share during my brief comments, so let me just share those right now. So my contribution to this project focuses on the evolving politics of migration in Oregon. I begin my chapter by asking why laws and policies affecting the lives of immigrants and refugees are routinely so contentious in Oregon and national life. My chapter highlights several factors. The first is that the demographic changes that immigrants and refugees produce regularly unsettle the economic, social, cultural, and political status quo. A second factor is that laws and policies governing migrants often reflect deeper battles over race, religion, and belonging. Third, in recent decades, immigrant and immigration politics have been shaped dramatically by partisan polarization, and as a result, this has made comprehensive immigration reform largely a pipe dream. A final factor is that we've had heightened intergovernmental struggle between Washington and the states, something that many of scholars describe as immigration federalism. My chapter devotes some attention to the longer history of Oregon's migration politics, a history that reflects traditions of white conquest, recruitment of migrant workers, and xenophobic nativism. Yet as we fast forward to 2017 to present, Oregon gained prominence as a sanctuary state opposed to restrictive Trump policies, defending the 1 in 10 Oregonians who were immigrants, including the state's 110,000 undocumented population. My chapter explores a key question. How did Oregon shift from a checkered history to recent laws and policies defending the rights and democratic inclusion of a diverse immigrant population? The first substantive section of my chapter provides a broad sweep on the foundations of migrant politics in Oregon from the 19th century to 1990. Don't worry, I'm not going to cover the 19th century now, but this includes an analysis of the Chinese exclusion movement in our state, which was quite strong, the Klan's anti-immigrant strands, restrictive alien land laws, and the support of most elected Oregonian leaders for racist national origins quotas in the 1920s and onward. It also looks at the post-World War II developments that signaled pro-migrant forces in Oregon and national political life. So for instance, during the 1960s and 80s, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 65 had significant support from Oregon's elected contingent in Congress, which played a leading role in passing that reform that dismantled racist quotas, while also providing new opportunities for Latin American and Asian migration to the country. During the 60s and 80s, you also saw the emergence of PECUN as an impactful union for farm workers and Latino working families in Oregon. This section of my chapter also tells the story of Rocky Barilla, a Democrat in the State House who wanted to fight profiling of Latinos based on his own experience doing local legal work, and how this led to Oregon passing a bipartisan sanctuary law, really by overwhelming margins of Republicans and Democrats in the State House in 1987. So my paper next examines the rise of a polarized politics in the state on migrant issues, particularly those involving undocumented people. In these years, we can see a tug of war in Oregon between those favoring broader immigrant rights and those advocating major restrictions. And in this regard, my chapter spends a lot of time talking about two dueling movements or lobbies, Oregonians for Immigration Reform and CALSA. It also examines the failed efforts of Representative Billy Dalto, a Republican from Salem, who tried to win tuition equity reform in the early 2000s. And he really stands as a big contrast with the story that I tell in the chapter about Rocky Barilla, who I mentioned a moment ago in terms of sanctuary law. For Dalto, what he encountered was deep partisan conflict and ultimately really impossible roadblocks within the Republican delegation in Salem, and he ended up, you know, feeling incredibly isolated within the party. This portion of my contribution also talks about competing protests in Oregon, those favoring immigration restriction, those at day laborer centers protesting, as well as immigrant rights movement protests during the same period, especially in 2006 and 7. I also try to highlight significant intergovernmental conflicts, such as those between ICE and city officials after the Portland raid of 2007. And we can also see state officials in these years pressured to meet federal demands, such as Governor Ted Kulongowski issuing an executive order on driver's licenses. And finally, as a substantive period, I spend a significant amount of time examining familiar struggles between restrictionist and immigrant rights forces in Oregon, but also significant breakthroughs for immigrants at the state level. A major success, for instance, for immigrant rights supporters was tuition equity reform in 2013, which for those of you who followed this issue in recent years know that it was more than a decade in the making. Yet only 1 year later, Oregonians for Immigration Reform won on Measure 88 in 2014, which found 68% of the state's voters rejecting driver's licenses for the undocumented. And within a context of steady ideological and partisan polarization, intergovernmental struggle assumes special importance as Oregon's Democratic governor and attorney general rigorously resisted the Trump administration's policies on a number of fronts, including the so-called Muslim ban, which saw significant protests in Oregon at Portland's airport and elsewhere, but also our attorney general joining other states in the courts to challenge this, this executive initiative. And then in 2018, as many of you know, you have the state sanctuary law that was put on the ballot, Measure 105, which won by a large margin. And finally, in this review of recent migrant politics in Oregon, I spent some time talking about the rise of a new BIPOC caucus in Salem, as well as the emergence of new leaders, elected leaders in immigrant politics, like Senator Casey Jama, who was a Somalian refugee and key immigrant rights advocate before taking this post. Yet despite these gains, I try to also underscore in this portion some of the real challenges in terms of getting diverse representation among elected leaders in Oregon. So let me just now turn to my conclusion. To wrap up, my chapter highlights how migrant politics in Oregon has been reshaped by increased demographic diversity, an increasingly impactful immigrant rights movement, partisan polarization, and new forms of immigration federalism, intergovernmental struggle. I also point to an important new book by Alan Coburn and Karthik Ramakrishnan, who use sophisticated analysis to compare all 50 states on questions of immigrant inclusion and exclusion. Their study finds that Oregon is among the nation's top five most inclusive states on key immigrant rights. This reflects quite a shift for a state whose early immigration policies were largely defined by nativism and racial hierarchy. However, if they had conducted their study only a few years earlier, when Measure 88 passed, when a large majority of voters opposed access to driving privileges for undocumented immigrants, their rankings would have looked quite different. Oregon would not have been in the top five. This takes me to basically a final thought. As my presentation hopefully has captured, the quest for democratic inclusion for Oregon migrants and their families has followed more of a crooked path rather than a straight line. Rather than a story of steady and smooth progress, both restrictive and inclusive traditions continue to influence state politics and policymaking. So we are left with both significant reforms in recent years and lingering challenges for the state. So thank you very much, and I will hand the baton to our next panelist.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jose Melendez, Assistant Professor of Planning at the School of Planning, Public Policy and Management. Thank you again to the City Club for inviting me today to present our research that began in the fall of 2019, aimed at documenting the terrain of decision-making bodies across the state of Oregon and the representation of immigrants on said body. To connect this to Dan's point at the end here, how inclusive or restrictive immigration policy is at the state level can be seen at more localized jurisdictions in how they include them in processes where decisions are made that impact their communities and livelihood. Decision-making bodies in this research refers to the various committees, commissions, and boards that jurisdictions create to advise or inform policymaking in action. These bodies are either required by laws and or used as a strategy to secure public buy-in for policy decision-making. Whether they are granted authority to make decisions or not, members who volunteer to serve on them have greater access to decision-makers and therefore are granted greater voice and or authority than the general public. We, in our research team, were motivated to shed light on what we think is a black box of participation that exists on these decision-making bodies with an unknown number of factors, such as how many boards exist across the state, who sits on these boards, the demographic makeup, and any efforts taken by jurisdictions to diversify them. Our research aimed to gather data to answer these questions and assess whether decision-making bodies are representative of the growing immigrant diversity in Oregon. This is key since we know that underserved communities lack meaningful representation at all levels of government bureaucracies. Therefore, having a role in decision-making bodies can be seen as an alternate way to influence policy and outcomes. In total, we capture 504 decision-making bodies in a board inventory we created for this chapter in this report. Once the board inventory was created, we went ahead and created a member inventory. Using publicly available information from the body's website, we proceeded to categorize the following information: total number of members, number of immigrants, whether they were first or second generation, their country of origin, and their educational attainment. Once immigrants' members were identified, we proceeded to contact members directly if possible, or through the designated staff person. At that point, we sent an additional short questionnaire asking for additional demographics of the board membership, such as gender and race ethnicity. Having completed both inventories, we were then able to run queries to find patterns and themes, which we report in this chapter, and I want to highlight a few in this presentation. It is worth noting that 100% of statewide bodies had public rosters, public available information about who was sitting on their decision-making bodies. Demographics were also recorded at nearly double the rate for statewide and special district bodies as compared to city and county. In particular, we found that at the county level, there were less resources and attention given to the management of decision-making bodies. County board websites were less transparent, and staff were often in charge of multiple bodies at once, in addition to their overall responsibilities. Meanwhile, cities range quite a bit in terms of transparency practices. For example, with Eugene looking more like a statewide board, while Springfield behaves similar to counties. Understanding the COVID hit in March of 2020, some of our data collection here was interrupted. Despite this, we had enough data to allow us to continue our work. Our findings indicate that the majority of bodies inventory do not have immigrant representation at all, nor do they track demographic information. While only making up 4% of all bodies inventory, statewide bodies were the most likely to have immigrant representation. Nearly 32% of statewide bodies have one or more immigrant members. This stands in contrast with other jurisdictions, which range as low as 10% and as high as nearly 13% of bodies with immigrant representation. You'll remember that 100% of statewide bodies had publicly accessible rosters, and 64% had demographics recorded. In fact, 59% of statewide bodies publicize members' names, biographies, and photos. This is unlike city bodies, where only close to 3% publish names, biographies, and photos. Relatedly, 41% of bodies that publicly listed members' names, biographies, and photos had at least one immigrant member. This stands in stark contrast with bodies that listed names only, which had immigrant representation 11% of the time. My point in sharing these numbers is that the amount of publicly available information, names, biographies, and photos, and other background information correlates strongly with having at some level of immigrant representation. This was regardless of whether it was a city, county, state, or special district jurisdiction. In addition to the inventories we created, we also interviewed the members, first generation and second generation individuals who sat on these bodies to get their insights on how serving was either a welcoming experience or a challenging one. We want to highlight some findings here, although there are more thorough discussions of these findings in the chapter itself. We want to focus on a few. First, recruitment. Intentional targeted efforts to diversify board membership beyond existing networks were identified as challenging to conduct. This may be inversely related to the power of networks, in which individuals were more likely to be invited to join because of their existing status and connections. Prior to recruitment, most members did not know about the existence of their respective bodies. This finding revealed the need for boards themselves and jurisdictions at large to demystify and clarify the role of boards and to educate the public by describing available board positions in order to increase the diversity of individuals applying. The role of networks. Participants spoke about knowing staff, elected officials, or others who had served or were connected to institutions related to the body's foci who had recruited them to join the boards. Our findings suggest that the board should spend time thinking about the types of networks they foster or lack access to as they seek to diversify their membership. 9 of the 30 non-white participants, or 30%, indicated that networks were based on race or related training programs, while 23% of the 30, 77% close to, reported that their networks centered on professional or related training programs. This brings us to the role of training programs prior to service. Not all participants received training related to civic engagement or leadership before joining the board. However, the 32 or close to 70% who did noted the impact of more substantial trainings, i.e. those lasting longer and involving a cohort of individuals, compared to one-off training experiences. These more substantial trainings fell into two categories, those that were identity-based and those for the general public. Identity-based trainings were targeted towards race, ethnicity, gender, or labor identities, such as union or farm workers, and they created or expanded the individual's networks, impacting the previously described finding. In this regard, we suggest that jurisdictions invest in, collaborate with, and sponsor trainings that are akin to the formidable ones that this research highlights as making a difference for expanding immigrant skills, knowledge, and access to networks. This investment can take on different forms, from providing stipends for participants to attend to offering childcare. Finally, in our chapter, we also highlight some policy recommendations, some of which I want to highlight here. First, increased transparency. Public websites should have key information, names, photos, and biography information. We want to put a literal face to the name of members. Secondly, there should be targeted outreach that is culturally relevant and specific. This includes promoting information on how to apply and the criteria for selection. Additionally, specific details and accommodations provided should be publicized. Ultimately, outreach needs to extend beyond existing known networks. Finally, improvements should be made to the onboarding of new members. This includes the explicit educational training on the body's missions and goals. Members should get to know one another, and bodies should develop a culture of inclusion. These recommendations support bodies in creating a community of practice together. I'd like to thank all of the members of the research team and the grant supporting this work, without which it would not be possible. And as I pass it over to Leisha, who talks about the role of integration, I want to connect it again back to Dan to talk about the challenge of achieving diverse representation of elected leaders. Oftentimes, it is a prerequisite for elected leaders to have experience sitting on these bodies. And so if we find, as we have, that these bodies are not representative of immigrant communities, then it is no wonder that we are not seeing representation at the elected level. And now I pass it on to Leisha.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Leisha Shrestha. Thanks for having me here. And I would like to thank City Club of Eugene for organizing this event. And then thanks to Bob for gathering all of us to be here and present our thoughts. So today I am talking about what it takes to integrate refugee and immigrant community, why integration is important, and how culturally specific approaches support the idea of integration. So earlier you heard from Dan and Jose talking about some broader policy aspects, right? So now I will talk about how we can do integration on the ground at the community level. And for this, I am drawing on my 10 years of work experience with refugee groups in Portland. So when Dan talked about nativism and nationhood, it reminded me of how refugee resettlement process policies and practices still carries and maintain the notion of assimilationist approach. And the only way we can overcome this is by integrating our newcomer refugee groups to our mainstream society, and also fostering intergroup dialogue between our mainstream and newcomer community. So here, let's talk about why we need integration, right? So I have seen that refugee and immigrant are often seen from the perspective, like, you know, someone who is very needy, someone need resources all the time, someone who has a lot of trauma, stresses. You know, we see them from deficit-based perspective rather than strength-based approach. So what I would like to say is, you know, we simply cannot negate the social cultural asset, skills, and experience they bring to our community. And studies have shown that they highly contribute in many sectors, be it the health sector, economy, or adding value to the social cultural fabric of our society. But what I would like to share is just bring some specific example here is refugee and immigrant-owned businesses. They are positively contributing to the revitalization of impoverished neighborhood and creating employment opportunity in the area, right? And you can see this example all over United States, and there are research that has been done. And, you know, despite their contribution, they encounter number of challenges, like acculturative resettlement stressors, institutional barriers, language issues, and racial biases. And most of them are resettled in unsafe neighborhoods. And one of those neighborhoods that I work is Outer East Portland. And that's where my organization, Division Midway Alliance, works in that area, the community, all the refugees that live in that area. So how we do integration, right? So we address the integration challenges by adopting culturally specific approach. One of the main theme of this approach is that organizations are led by communities of color, community members. They hire people who are from the community, and we call them cultural liaisons, right? And who are cultural liaisons? They are the trusted members of the community who speaks the community's language, share their lived experience, and act as a bridge builders. So they help us build trust with the community, build network of relationships. So anything that we do is sustainable. And at the end, it supports the community, uplift their voice, right? And I would like to bring your attention to two stories. I'm highlighting two stories here. One is Loi Washi. She is a current community member from Myanmar, and she joined our organization in 2018 as one of the cultural liaison. So when she joined our organization, we connected her to Oregon Food Bank, the program called Seed to Supper program. She and her husband put together a training program on gardening, community gardening. And as a result of that, 13 community members got a plot of land to grow culturally specific food, right? And this resulted in creating their own nonprofit. They received a grant, and they leased a big farmland in Boring area. And last year, they distributed those produces for free to their community and community members who are outside of their community. So this shows that they are already giving back. They are supporting people during the pandemic. And now they have started selling produces at the People's Market in Rockwood area, already doing income generation activities. And I would like to bring one specific point here is, you know, this has particularly helped supported elderly members who have been socially isolated for many years. And this has really helped them improve their overall well-being and also connected them with some income generation opportunity. I would like to, you know, conclude my presentation here by saying, you know, culturally specific approach and bringing integration to our practice and policy not only help maintain their cultural identity or create a holistic approach to address their basic need, but also help mainstream communities be part of the integration process. And there are some examples in the chapter where the mainstream community members have explained, you know, how this kind of interaction helped them to elevate their role in creating foundation, co-creating solution. And this has also helped them improve their social and cultural capital. And they have started gaining benefit from new economic opportunity, whether it's in nonprofit sector, whether it's building more spaces for community garden, you know. And these are all the stories from mainstream community members as well. And it's in the chapter. So what I would like to say, let's voice for integration rather than following the assimilation approach, and that will work for everyone, all of us, and create a sense of belonging at the same time.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.